On the way over here, I took a cab from my house, and the young man wanted some legal advice when he found out where I was going. I told him to call a good lawyer, but I didn't give him any names. Today we're going to be introduced to this man. His name is Richard Alvin Woodring, and that is a photograph. It's a little off because it is a photograph of a Xerox that appeared in the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. Dick Woodring was born in 1932, and this photograph was taken in 1957 or 58. As you can see, he meets the, well, first of all, I should tell you, the FBI, when they arrested him, took his measurements. He was 6'1" and weighed 205 pounds. He was dark-haired, dark-eyed, and in that photograph, he looks like a male model out of Gentleman's GQ or one of the magazines of that time, or even somebody who could serve as the backup for Gregory Peck in The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit. Woodring arrived in Fairbanks in 1957 or 58, and the title, the best-looking guy who ever had hit Fairbanks, was given to him by Jack Sexton, who owned a bar in Fairbanks for 50-something years, and knew Woodring well, and himself was considered himself quite a beau. So that was quite a compliment to our friend Dick here as the best-looking guy who ever hit Fairbanks. I knew Dick Woodring, I think I could say, from afar, really, in effect, hero worship. In the fall of 1958, a group of people in Fairbanks decided that they would form a football club, an adult football club, to compete in the military league. Dick Woodring was the coach and quarterback of this particular football team, and every Sunday or every Saturday, I would go out to Ladd Field, make my way out there, and watch Dick Woodring play football. And during the week, he would be quoted in the newspaper at some length. So it was I met him, I guess you could say, through hero worship, as somebody who wanted to see a real football game and a real quarterback and got to see Dick Woodring. I would have been 13 or 14 at that time, just about to turn 14. Dick Woodring would have been forgotten by history and by myself, forgotten by everybody but his family, except for the following. On January 12th, 1959, which coincidentally was the first day that the Alaska legislature met as we were the new state, a masked bandit walked into the Alaska National Bank branch in Fairbanks and robbed the bank of $14,000 at gunpoint. All that was known of the gunman at that time is he was tall, it was January, it was very cold, he was wearing a very heavy parka, and he had a scarf over his face, and he had a handgun. This was, needless to say, the first bank robbery of the new state's history, and apparently, from what I can tell, it was not only the largest bank robbery, it was definitely the largest bank robbery in Fairbanks history, but may have been the largest bank robbery to that time in the history of the territory and the state. The FBI immediately got on the job and began to do a search. These photographs, in some degree, are poor or limited because they are these are off Xeroxes. The original photographs do not exist, or at least to my knowledge, do not exist because of a couple of reasons. One was the Fairbanks flood. The other is the Fairbanks News Miner did not have a photography department. They hired private contractors to act as their photographers, and many of these photographs, photographers just took their work with them when they left. Anyway, the FBI got busy looking for the bank robber. And Doug Pope may remember some of this, I know others do. Big search to include far north. This was really quite something because the question was, it would still be today, how do you get out of Alaska? Where do you go? What do you do? How are you going to spend the money? So there were various theories about the tall parka bandit that he had that he was hiding out in perhaps in a cabin somewhere in the distance. That he had a friend who had an airplane, a small airplane, and had taken him to some lake where he was going to be holed up for the winter. The FBI started asking questions all over Fairbanks, And this will show you something of the how the economy was at the time. Anybody who, not anybody, but people who spent, brought a, went into a business and bought something with a $50 bill, they would find later that day that the FBI came to their house to ask them, where did you get that $50 bill? Tell us about it. So this major search began all over Alaska. The FBI was involved. Local people were involved. This was a cause célèbre, the bank robbery at gunpoint. The FBI wasn't getting anywhere. Neither were the local police departments. Then, in a couple weeks after the robbery, the FBI got the tip that broke the case. Some of you here will know either professionally or personally Red Boucher. At that time, Red Boucher owned a sporting goods supply store in Fairbanks. And Red knew Dick Woodring and had helped him with his football team. Well, Red remembered that the day of the robbery, Dick Woodring had come to his house and said, you know, I'm leaving Alaska, I'm going outside. Could you, I'm flying out tonight. I have some hunting gear I'd like to leave in your storage area here at Fairview Manor. Can we do that? And Red said, sure, and took it into the storage area in Fairview Manor. Red said, thinking about that particular occasion, this was a week or 10 days later, whenever it was, you know, I wonder what's in that bag. He looked in the bag. There was a parka, a scarf, and a small caliber pistol. He called the FBI. The FBI was able to trace Dick Woodring very easily. They traced him first that he'd flown on Alaska Airlines to Los Angeles, he'd bought a car, and he'd returned to his home in Oklahoma, where he was originally from. He went to see his sister in Tulsa, and then went to see his mother also, who lived not far from Tulsa. The FBI made many visits to the relatives, the brother-in-law's home, Mr. Small, and finally got a search warrant, and Woodring agreed to let them search the house, and they found thousands and thousands of dollars in small bills and medium-sized bills in several shoeboxes, or maybe it was one large shoebox, and they arrested Woodring. This is the FBI officer talking. I exhibited the contents to Mr. Woodring and again asked him if the contents were his. He replied, I don't know. And I asked him if he'd ever seen the contents before, and he replied, I do not know. At that moment, he began to get red in the face and started crying and exclaiming to his mother, no one will believe me. He was arrested and brought back to Fairbanks. As you can see here, this is the headline, another sensational headline. Sports figures arrest announced. Gunman's lurid past turns up as FBI. Dick Woodring in Tulsa was baseball, football player. We're going to talk about his lurid past in just a moment, but I want to talk about his past in another sense. A couple of years ago, I was over in Soldotna visiting a former U.S. Deputy Marshal who some of you may have met. His name is Frank Wirth. He just died recently as a very old man. He'd been a member of the territorial legislature. He had been a deputy marshal in Fairbanks. He had been a private detective in Anchorage. He knew a lot about old Alaska, and he also knew a lot about some of the characters of that time. He was showing me a variety of documents that he had at his house, and also things like True Detective magazine and Police Gazette. He'd been in these magazines with Alaska stories, so that was part of what he wanted to show me. But he also had something that I had never seen before and couldn't imagine existed. It was this. In 1958, Richard Alvin Dick Woodring, the man we've just been talking about, ran for the first Alaska legislature. This is a statement that he submitted to the voters that was printed in the newspaper. Woodring ran as a Democrat. In those days, you had multi-member districts. The districts were very big. And I believe it was seven people were going to be selected from Fairbanks at that particular time. This was a period of great enthusiasm, of great optimism, of great belief in what government could do. The number of people who ran for the legislature was astonishing, both down here and in Anchorage and in Fairbanks. And Woodring was one of those people who ran for the legislature. He'd only been here a couple of years, but he ran for the legislature. He finished in about the middle of the pack. In other words, 7 Democrats were nominated, and I think he finished like 12th out of 18 that ran for the Democratic nominations. Now, in this letter, Joe, can you read it from back there or not? I'm sorry, Joe. This Joe, that Joe. Okay, well, let me give you the summary of this. My name is R.A. Woodring. I'm writing this letter to let you know I'm running for the House. I was born in the state of Kansas and lived there until 1936, when my father, Harry Woodring, twice governor of that state, was appointed Secretary of War by President Roosevelt. I worked as a page in the United States Senate as a young boy. Then he goes on to tell that he toured Alaska at one point. He'd been up here with his father. He went on to say in World War II, he served as a combat fighter pilot in both Europe and the Pacific. He was a reservist called to active duty in Korea. He was a prisoner of war in Korea. And he's a graduate of Tulane University. And from there, he goes on to write, I think, quite well, a bit of an essay on my philosophy of resource development, why I'm a good Democrat, what I can offer Alaska. Now, when I read this, I thought about this for a while, and I thought, you know, a guy who would rob a bank probably, and I do appreciate this, I'm glad somebody noticed, a guy who would rob a bank might make up his story when he was running for the legislature. So I checked. There was a Harry Woodring, and he was the governor of Kansas. That's Harry. He was the governor from 1930 to 1932. He was also Secretary of War briefly for Franklin Roosevelt. Harry Woodring is no relative of Dick Woodring. He'd never heard of Dick Woodring, or rather I should say he's deceased. I found his son in Topeka, who's a consulting engineer, and I called him up and I told him this story about Dick Woodring had used his father when he ran for the legislature up here. Mr. Woodring, the younger, was quite charmed by this. He said, you know, it just never occurred to me that anybody would care. So he was, it rather amazed him that somebody, it meant something to him that somebody had remembered his father. Now, to go back for a second, in talking about Dick here, I got him upside down and backwards and the whole works. I went on to check out some of the other things. So Dick Woodring was never in Washington, D.C. working as a page. He never toured Alaska with his father, who was Secretary of Defense, because Harry Woodring was not his father. He was never in World War II, as far as I can tell. He was not in the Korean War, and certainly wasn't captured. It's easily accessible to find records of people who were captured during the Korean conflict. And as a matter of fact, when the Korean conflict began, Richard Alvin Woodring was in jail. He is not a graduate of Tulane University. So this is a remarkable statement to the voters. Usually people will make up their master's degree from the University of Wisconsin, as we had somebody up here that I remember. But this guy went for the whole ball of wax. Whether he believed any of this other stuff about resource development, I couldn't tell you. So who was he? The one thing that is absolutely true on there is he was born in Kansas. Richard Alvin Woodring was born in Kansas City, Kansas. Anybody here from there by any place? Do we have anybody from Kansas here? You're from that town?
Oh, no, not from that town.
Okay. Did I get the pronunciation correct?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. And this is who he was according to the 1930 census. His father, and that's a typo, it should be Orville Woodring. His mother is Gladys Woodring. They were farm people who had gone down to central Oklahoma to farm. One of the interesting details about Dick Woodring's life is he was an Osage Indian. And they had, in some way, it is quite clear that his mother and father benefited from being members of the Osage tribe. The Osage were the Indians who were the proverbial Oklahoma Indians who hit oil, or oil was hit on their land. This, I thought you'd find interesting, is a registration of Dick Woodring as on the Indian census rolls. There he is as Richard Alvin. That gives his birth date and so forth. He is 1/16 It's interesting that that they would note that, and to be even included on this, and I'm not an expert on Oklahoma Indian registration, but I believe you had to be registered in the census, the Indian census of 1900, the Osage census, to be in any way a participant in this particular tribal activity. His father was a farmer. His mother was a homemaker. The people, they may have done other work in Pawhuska, Oklahoma. If anybody's from around knows that area, that's where they were from, the Osage Nation. His brother, Carlton Woodring, or Carl Woodring, was a very distinguished traditional Osage painter. This is a painting, you'll notice this kind of flat quality to it. Apparently that's very much desired in that tradition. Carl or Carlton Woodring's work has appeared in many places in Europe, in London, it's in the Smithsonian, in the major museums of New Mexico and Oklahoma, in Texas, and all over the United States in venues. In fact, a couple of years ago, they had a major retrospective of Carlton's work at the St. Louis Museum of Art in St. Louis. His brother was quite a distinguished artist. So that is the background that Dick Woodring really had compared to what he said when he ran for the legislature. Now here you'll see crime career revealed after arrest. And essentially what this told us in the stories that came out is Woodring had come to Alaska. He hadn't vented himself. He'd been in prison at least twice. First in Cook County, Illinois, when he bought a car with a bad check and just kept the car. And it's interesting because when the people came up, showed up, and it seemed to have gone this way and said, he gave us a bad check for that car. He just sort of said, so what's your point? And they went and got the law, and he went to jail for several months. He served 2 months in Cook County prison or jail on a two-year sentence. In 1947, he was in Lubbock, Texas. And in Lubbock, he was arrested for embezzling. And in 1950, entered prison and served more than a year there from embezzling from a car distributor in Lubbock. And he was in prison when the Korean War broke out. And eventually he moved to Michigan and then came to Alaska. I've been able to find that much about his history. Now here's the trial began in 1960 in June. This would be a year and some months later from his arrest. His attorneys were Gene Miller of Fairbanks, who some of you would know. Chancey, you were in the legislature with him, right? And Gene was from Oklahoma and may have known Gene Miller there. It wasn't clear to me. I talked to Gene's widow, Frances, and she wasn't quite sure about it, their relationship, except that that Gene Miller had been part of the defense. But his major lawyer was a man named Tommy Frazier, who was the premier criminal defense lawyer in in Tulsa. And Dick Woodring's mother and his family had hired Frazier, who was a World War II veteran and was confined to a wheelchair, and brought him to Fairbanks to conduct the trial. This was very, very difficult, the traveling, as you can imagine, in 1959, 1960, 61 in there, for somebody with those kind of handicaps. The trial lasted a few days, and as you'll see here, within a few hours, Woodring was found guilty. Gene Miller made it a point in the trial that there was no, the witnesses, the people who worked at the bank, none of them could identify Woodring. The evidence was essentially what Boucher had in the bag, the money, and Woodring's lack of plausibility in explaining how he had been broke, how everybody who knew him said he was broke, yet he had like $10,000 or $12,000 in this shoebox when he got back to Oklahoma, plus trying to account for where he had been when the robbery occurred. He had no real credible account except he was hanging out at Sportland, which is the old lunch counter and pinball machine headquarters, because I know that personally from my own experience. When this happened, and he had a couple of witnesses who said they saw him there maybe between such and such a time and maybe between such and such another time, who were very, very poor witnesses, you can tell from the transcript. And, I'm embarrassed to say this. I didn't look at the transcript most recently, But I'm pretty sure that Woodring himself did not testify at this trial. Woodring appealed this to the Ninth Circuit after he was convicted. And the Ninth Circuit took up the case. And to my amazement, three of the justices came to Fairbanks in 1961, in September of 1961, to hear the case. They're the three judges who came up to hear Woodring's appeal. Well, in 1961, we're now getting to be almost two years after the robbery, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals overturned Dick Woodring's conviction. And their reasoning was this. They said quite specifically that they were having to let a guilty man go. What had happened, for the few who are around here in territorial days will remember this, Dick Woodring, a bank robbery and indictment and trial took place at a ripe period in Alaska history. It was the transition of the court system from the territorial courts to the state courts. The Ninth Circuit found that he had been indicted in a territorial court and convicted in a federal court and told the Fairbanks, or told Alaskans, you can't do that. And so Woodring's conviction was overturned. It's an interesting question, which I have yet to research, of how many other cases there would have been like this. But my own sense is that this was the premier felony, this bank robbery case, of particular cases that fell into this unusual situation of the court transition. You'll notice there, Woodring in jail again, Tulsa, Oklahoma. Well, the boy couldn't stay out of trouble. He and his wife had a falling out. He confronted her on a street in Tulsa. This is while he was out on appeal, right? His case had been appealed. It's waiting for the retrial. This material, till they indicted him again, we're going to go through all the motions of convicting him again. He got in trouble. He kidnapped his wife. He took her at gunpoint to his mother's house. He threatened to shoot her. His mother tried to talk sense to him. And these, by the way, are from the Tulsa newspapers. They had a file on him. He was arrested and thrown in jail for the threats to his wife. Now, this is a couple months later, where Dick and Jerry Bill Hopkins escaped from the Grove, from the Delaware County Jail in Jay, Oklahoma. And I'm going to this is something I haven't sucked it up to do because I'm a coward. Jerry Bill Hopkins is in the phone book in Oklahoma City. I haven't called him. But it's part of my responsibility to do that. Anyway, Jerry Bill gave himself up, and Dick walked, as he explained later, all the way to Tulsa, some 70 miles or 80 miles, claimed he lived off the land, except he didn't walk all the way. At one point, he stole a car. Another point, he broke into a man's house and waited for the guy to come home. And when the guy came home at gunpoint, took the man's car keys. And this, I thought, was really quite inventive. And I hadn't heard about anybody doing this except, and I don't think you could do it except in Kansas, Nebraska, and the old Southwest, would be he took the man outside and put him in the storm cellar that was near this farm and then parked the guy's pickup truck on top of the storm cellar so he couldn't get out. So here's Woodring getting into this guy's car, which he is stealing, while the guy is in the storm cellar yelling, let me out, let me out. In any case, eventually Dick came up, and that's Dick. As you can see, the time is beginning to wear on him, and that's his lawyer there, Tommy Frazier, who still was representing him. Tommy Frazier, I guess, got to represent him in all these cases, the breaking and entering, the robbery, and so forth. Anyway, Dick got 2 years on this escape. He was also found guilty of threatening and menacing his wife and pulling a gun on her. So as his case proceeded, the appeal, the re-indictment, and so forth, he was in an Oklahoma jail doing time on these other measures. Eventually, There was a second trial in Fairbanks, and in 1963, and this is by this time I was a senior in high school, Doug Pope and I both were, Woodring was convicted and sentenced to 15 years in a federal prison. This is his federal prison record, and it's interesting for a couple reasons. You can see Richard Alvin Woodring, Fairbanks, Alaska, bank robbery. One of the things that he did, and his sentence changed, was he escaped from Leavenworth and led the Kansas officials a merry chase for a while in that part of the world until he was arrested. And then he was transferred to Marion, Illinois, which those of you who follow the criminal law know is, at that time, was certainly among one of the premier facilities for hard criminals. And that's where he went, that's where he served a good part of his time in jail. Woodring was released from jail in 1976. This would have been, so he was in some measure involved with the criminal justice system from the day he walked into that bank, they were looking for him in 1959, until 1976. I'm told by Frances Miller, who's Gene Miller's wife, that that Gene felt that this was a tremendous injustice and that Woodring never should have been arrested or convicted, that he didn't do it, and that Frances Miller told me that after Gene Miller lost this case on behalf of Woodring, that he never practiced criminal law again because he felt so strongly about it. I also interviewed a lawyer in San Francisco named John Vlahos, who was involved in Woodring's appeal. And this will give you some measure of the guy's charm. This would have been in one of the great law offices of San Francisco in the 60s. Dick Woodring showed up there looking for somebody besides his Fairbanks lawyers to handle his appeal. He walked in, this is after he had a variety of troubles with the legal system in Oklahoma, in Alaska, in other places, and said, Vlahos said, you know, Mr. Woodring, I'm very sympathetic to your case here, but you do realize we'll have to start with $5,000 on the table if we're going to even file this appeal. Woodring just looked at him and said, no problem, and handed them the money. Where did he get the money? My guess is mom. Dick Woodring repeatedly in this story goes back again and again and again to his mother in Pawhuska, Oklahoma, who seems to have had some, if not exactly well, some, she was a stable figure who had some degree of money and she took care of him. And this is the area of Oklahoma, from those of you who aren't familiar with it, that we're talking about. Tulsa's down here, whoops. Grove is where his mother lived eventually. Jay is where he broke out of jail. And Pawhuska is where the Osage Nation is. There's another interesting thing I mentioned to you about Woodring while he was on the run from the law. He locked up the guy in the storm drain. He also went to his brother's house, and his brother wasn't there, and Dick was hiding out there. This is Carlton, the artist. And Woodring, when the marshals came, they didn't know who Dick Woodring was. They only knew him by name. He convinced them that he was his brother and got them to leave the premises, and only a couple hours later did they realize that they'd been had by him. Now, I found Dick Woodring's niece. It was the only member of the family I could find who was a bartender in Galveston, Texas. And she, at first, was totally put off by me and thought I was going to try and get rich on the miserable story of her dad and or her uncle and all the things that had happened. She'd come up here later with her other uncles, and they tried to get construction work up here. And she knew Dick very well. She didn't believe that he'd robbed the bank. She said he was too much of a coward. He'd probably faint at the sight of a gun. But in any case, I mailed her a variety of materials that dealt with her uncle, and we established a pretty good relationship because I was able to tell her things about her own family that she did not know. She told me that while Dick Woodring, that when Dick Woodring got out of jail, he went back to Pawhuska, Oklahoma, and a very, I know this is going to sound like it's a ridiculous central casting type story, a very homely, rich Indian woman fell in love with him and took care of him. And that they moved for a while to Sun City, and then came back to Pawhuska, Oklahoma, where he died. This is his obituary from Pawhuska. He died in 1993. Also says he was a member of the American Legion Post in the United States Air Force. If there's, I don't know what he told the people at the post. If there's any indication that he had military service in World War II, I have been through many different record centers and I cannot find anything. And now, with the kind of modern search engines you have with Ancestry.com and those kind of opportunities, I find nothing that suggests that he was a veteran of World War II. Now, I have two footnotes for you that I think are pretty wonderful. I'll advertise them that way sort of shamelessly. The first is this. You can put in, at one point it was being sold, and now I think they've changed it so you can't, but you could just put in anybody's name, anybody in this room, whoever it is, into a ProQuest is the search engine, and they had online the New York Times, the Chicago Tribune, the Chicago Defender, the Boston Globe, the Washington Post, and two or three other of the big newspapers. So just for fun, I put in Dick Woodring. What do you suppose showed up? Dave Philly, I know him. He was a major league ball player, goes on to talk there at the bottom. Let me just do this here. This is from the sports page of the Chicago Tribune. The Sox squad was minus Carlton Dick Woodring today, the athlete having been carried away by authorities to answer charges of writing bum checks in Potter County, Texas. That's Amarillo. Carlton is his brother's name. So I'm convinced this is the same guy, but it's going to take more than that to prove it. The other thing is this. There's a lawyer in Fairbanks named Eugene Bellin. Does anybody here know him or ever had any dealings with him? Gene's in his 70s. I think he does mostly real estate law and some probate law. I went over to his law office the other day, and when he got out of the Army in 1959 or 60, he went to work for Gene Miller. And he participated, along with this Lajos in San Francisco and Miller, in the appeal that Woodring filed to the Ninth Circuit, and in also when Woodring was tried the second time. So he'd met Dick Woodring. He knew Dick Woodring in a kind of superficial way that a young lawyer would know to see to come into the office while the senior members of the law firm would deal with his particular problem. He hadn't seen Dick Woodring since 1962, which is what, 45 years ago? But Mr. Bellin, being an organized person and a much more organized person than myself, said, just a minute, I'll go get his file. And he did. He brought it back in about 5 minutes. The file contained a variety of things that dealt with the appeal, but they contained one, I thought, marvelous personal note that Gene Bellin had written to himself during a telephone conversation he had with Dick Woodring in 1963. This was what, or 65. This would have been after he was convicted, when he was in jail, when he was trying to get out of jail. This is when he was convicted for the bank robbery in Fairbanks, I should say. Woodring called at 6:30 a.m. Woodring says, and this is the classic, what is the criminal who's been convicted and he's in jail, tell people who can get him out of jail, what is he going to offer them? I know who really did it. I know who really did it. He is a professional. His partner is down dead. I can prove he was there. He was a client of Frazier's. If you get me out of jail, I will deliver the man who did it. That is the story of Dick Woodring. Thank you. I know you all have to go places and do things, but if anybody has any questions, I'll do my best. Sir?
On the FOIA request that you have about his Bureau of Prisons, mm-hmm. It looked like they said that they got 20 more years for another bank robbery.
I think that's all.
Did you repeat the question?
The question was, did he receive additional time for another bank robbery? My impression was that these were, I don't think that's the case, that it had to deal with, he had escaped several times and time kept getting added. His time, for a while, got longer, not shorter. because of these escapes and other things that had happened. Yeah. Sir?
Were there any details of his escape from Leavenworth?
No, you know, I looked in the, I don't know that that happens every day, but I looked in the Leavenworth, the hometown newspaper, and also the Kansas City Star, and I was only able to find one newspaper account. And this was kind of interesting because there were three or four of these guys who were working on the farm there at Leavenworth where they were providing food. And Woodring, three or four of them walked off, and Woodring was the last one caught. They probably made it 40 or 50 miles away. Yes?
One of the transparencies you had up had a headline that made some reference to somebody suing the FBI for $3,000 or something like that. Was that Woodring?
No. That's actually a good question. I forget what that is at the present time. I'll have to go back and look at that to give you a better answer. Yes?
What kind of a sentence did he get for the escape
level at that time? You know, that's unclear to me. That's on that same page there where they added some time to him. The main thing they did is they transferred him to Marion. And he had been, in effect, a day worker at the prison, and they told him, no more of that. We're sending you to where the bad guys go. Did he have a job in Fairbanks? It appears that that he from time to time did some expediting work for some construction firms, but mostly he enjoyed the pleasure of his friends and their money, as far as I can tell. And he did have a wife, and he did have two children, and I don't know how he made all that work, but I do know that by the time that he robbed the bank, he was broke. Okay, thank you all. I appreciate you coming out to listen, and it's always fun to be here.